Far away in the Rocky Mountain region, we have a little reading program that we follow. We also have a study guide that we follow. We get together every year and early in the year and decide what chapters or what books we will study. And then that means that the whole region is studying the same chapter of the Bible every week. This year we studied 1 Timothy and Acts and Titus. And then we follow a little reading guide so that we're all in the same reading program. My own personal study, however, in addition to this, for the past year I've been studying back to the Pentateuch, back in Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Kind of a little side hula hoop going over here, you know, while the main thing is going here. I studied Acts, I went through the whole business with the rest of them. But I became interested in this last year, about this time last year, when my wife and I were in New Zealand. And we were living there for a week in this conference grounds, and my regular reading was back in here. In fact, that's when I picked up this little reading program, was when I was out there in Australia and New Zealand. And they had us reading back in Exodus, and so I was reading it along, and it occurred to me that God had put these people in the book of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy through a training program, like what you're going through. But this one that these people went through lasted 40 years. They were in the thing for about 40 years, I understand. 40 years of discipline, 40 years of training. But this training program, it transformed these people from a nation of slaves. They had been in slavery for over two centuries. They were beaten in will, they were beaten in spirit, they were downtrodden, they had lost all heart, they were nothing but slaves. And God took these people, and in 40 years he transformed these people into a nation of conquerors who could face anything that was before them and overcome it. It took him 40 years to do that, but that's what he did. So what I've been doing is just going through here, just leafing through the Bible, and I would sit and I would just look at this, and I would do my study, and then I would jot down ideas as I went through. And I would see things and just saw page by page. I've been following this training program through as kind of a little side study. And that's what I'd like to try to start sharing with you this morning. As I see it, there were about five or six main lessons that he taught them, main things, apart from Deuteronomy 30, when he sort of summarized the key issues. So we'll try to get into the first one this morning. If you'd like to turn to it, you can turn to Exodus chapter 16. This is the first time that he makes any attempt to teach these people anything. We'll read Exodus 16, 1, probably down through 8. And they took their journey from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came into the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departing out of the land of Egypt. They haven't been gone from Egypt very long now. Month, 15 days. Exodus 16:2. And the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness, and the children of Israel said unto them, Would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots, and when we did eat bread to the full. For you have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill us, this whole assembly, with hunger. Then said the Lord unto Moses, Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people will go out and gather a certain rate every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or no. And it shall come to pass that on the sixth day they shall prepare that which they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily. And Moses and Aaron said unto all the children of Israel, at even, then shall you know that the Lord hath brought you out of the land of Egypt. Apparently, by the way, by this time they had been discussing among themselves whether or not it was God that really brought them out. They were trying to decide whether or not maybe God hadn't really brought them here. And I don't know whether it's happened to you yet or not, but probably before long down here, sometime or other, you will probably wonder about that. Was it really God that brought me down to this place, you know? Going to kill us all with hunger down here or whatever he's going to do, you know? They faced that. Am I really in the will of God? Has God really brought me to this place? That's what they were wondering. Well, Moses said, you're going to find out that it was God. And in the morning, then shall you see the glory of the Lord, for that he heareth your murmurings against the Lord. And what are we that you murmur against us? And Moses said, this shall be, when the Lord shall give you in the evening flesh to eat, and in the morning bread to the full, for that the Lord heareth your murmurings, which you murmur against him. And what are we? Your murmurings are not against us, but against the Lord. See, in verse 2, it says, they murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. But in verse 8, we learn that their murmurings were not really against Moses and Aaron, but against the Lord. That, by the way, is when the sovereignty of God is really tested in a man's life. When he thinks that he's got the thing scoped out better than his leader has, or better than the person over him in the thing, and he can see all kinds of flaws in this guy, and he begins to complain and murmur, not necessarily audibly, but in his heart. He has what is called a silent conversation. He has this mental argument, and he can argue with this guy and put him down every time. I mean, every time he can do it, see, because he says, oh, he just said this, I just said that, and then he just said, and then I'd have had him. And this mental argument is so easy to fall into. You know, it's just one of those, it's a constant thing with us, unless a guy licks it. And you can lick that. You know, that's something that can be licked. And about 15 years ago, I decided that I would not allow myself the luxury of a mental argument. Because it's a real luxury. Oh, it's just, you can wallow in it. You just lay there and just, oh, you know, and it feels so good. Because you win every time. Against this guy that you've become to hate, see? But if you just get that settled, that you will not allow yourself the luxury of a mental argument, it really eases the pain. You know, it really helps you. And I think it's a big step in a man's life. The first time that I guess, really got this thing and began to settle it was I had been in Seattle with a guy named Gordon Donaldson. Gordon Donaldson and his wife, Chris, they were heading up the Nav home there. I was living in the Nav home as one of the trainees. And I had been with Don Rosenberger, for about 2 years in Minneapolis. Now, Don Rosenberger was an old-time navigator, been saved from the Navy. And he caught a wide swath when he moved. When he moved through, everything fell in front of him. You know, he was one of these wheeler dealers. He could have 17 hula hoops going at once, you know, and keep them all going. You know, just one of these guys. Well, I moved in with this guy, Donaldson. Now, Donaldson was a producer, but he walked very carefully through life, you know, and didn't cut a very wide swath. But where he did go, he accomplished things. And every time he would do something, I'd say to myself, not the way Rosenberger would do it. That's not the way Don Rosenberger would do it. Well, there are two or three reasons why that's true. The simple, obvious reason is that there's only one Don Rosenberger, you know. And nobody else is supposed to be Don Rosenberger. But I didn't know that. Now, I don't know where you are in your spiritual development. I assume that you're all, you know, advanced trainees, whatever that means in the navigators these days, if that's what you're supposed to be. But one of these days, you will not be with the guy that brought you up or with the gal that brought you up, you know, your favorite here, see. whether it's, you know, Vedano or Mayhall or Russ Johnson or whoever it is that's been around that you've kind of been following along, one of these days you're going to find yourself under somebody else. And he's going to be leading the bunch, and you're going to be kind of new in the thing. And every time this guy does something, you're going to be tempted to say, that's not the way so-and-so would do it. Now, I know that's true, because guys have told me that's the way they feel when they come to my region. You know, they come out there, they see me operating, and they look back in the good old days, and they say, oh, that I. Oh, what a meathead. You know, blah, blah, blah. Well, I know that because I did that thing. Well, I was sitting one day and having one of these arguments, and I was complaining, of all things, to Rosenberger about Donaldson. And Rosenberger said, let me show you a verse. Numbers 12, 1 and 2. So I flipped over to Numbers 12, 1 and 2. And he read it to me. And Miriam and Aaron spake against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married. For he had married an Ethiopian woman. And they said, hath the Lord indeed spoken only by Moses? Hath he not also spoken by us? And the Lord heard it. God hears that murmuring. And the Lord heard it. And then he sat in this car for about, oh, I guess 20 minutes, and explained to me how the navigators could not use a guy like me. Or it was all over as far as he was concerned. I was through. He had put up with me for 2 years in Minneapolis. He had tried to give me some extra help by sending me to Seattle for a year of training with Donaldson. I had blown the whole business, and so I was done. Goodbye. Man, you know, heart flop on the ground. You know, what do I do now? Well, the first thing I did, I went out and I prayed all night. Went out and just prayed. You know, God, you know. So then God took me. I went to the Psalms, and I was in this Psalms, and I remember it said something about His truth extended to the clouds, but His mercy to the heavens. I thought, oh, good night. There's the overshadowing mercy of God, just the truth. You know, I violated the truth of God. It only extends to the clouds. But the mercy, so I began to claim the mercy of God. God, mercy. All I could plead was mercy. That was it. Just pure mercy. Because I knew I'd sinned. I knew I'd blown it. And they'd booted me out, you know. So now here I was out here roaming around, not knowing what to do next. So then a guy named Gabby Glockner, most of you guys have never heard of Gabby Glockner. Glockner at the time headed up to work in Minneapolis. I'm sorry, he was at the Glen. He wanted to go to Minneapolis, and I wanted to go to be with Rosenberger so bad to get some further help, and I wanted Don to take me. But there was no chance for Glockner to get to Minneapolis, and there was no chance for me to go to Washington, D.C. with Rosenberger. I knew that. So we decided we would pray. And we were at Star Ranch. The Navs didn't have Glen Eyrie at the time, so it was Star Ranch. And I don't know if you've ever been to Star Ranch, but the dust at Star Ranch is about that deep down along the ball field. So the two of us went out and said, let's get before God and really prove to God that we really mean this. So we laid down on our face in the dust, nose in the dust, dust seeping up through here, you know, and began to pray. And when we'd pray, I'd look over at Glockner on the little dust ball to be praying. And there we are, about 4 inches in dust, laying there, praying to God that He'd somehow not, you know, do this thing to us, you know, that had been told us. And then we heard the bell. You weren't late in meetings in those days. You had to be on time. When Trotman spoke, you were on time, see. So we hurried up there and just as we round the corner, we were dusting the dust off us, you know, trying to get presentable again for the meeting. Dawson Trotman stopped me. He says, where are you going? I said, I'm giving the meeting on time. Let me ask you a question. Yes, sir. How would you like to be in Washington, D.C. with Rosenberger? All right. Great. Oh, praise the Lord. See? Well, the Lord brought me through that little thing, and I learned a real lesson in it. The main lesson I learned was this business of murmuring, you know. I mean, I was, up to that time, everything that happened, murmur, 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 murmur. But God taught a lesson along the way. Well, the sovereignty of God, you see, is tested in this thing. See, doctrinally, you can say, I believe in the sovereignty of God. But do you believe that God is sovereign in your situation now? That's where the sovereignty of God really comes to the test. especially when you've got a guy over you that you don't really think much of, or you think maybe isn't really the, you know, the sharpest guy on earth. And David went out whithersoever Saul sent him and behaved himself wisely. Was Saul a good leader? Next time you have a chance to murmur against your leader, ask yourself this. Has he ever thrown a javelin at me? David jumping out of the way of these javelins, you know, flying around the room. But he still went out whithersoever Saul sent him and behaved himself wisely. You know. So, I mean, it is, you know, you see this in the scriptures. So then they began, you know, what God, we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we ate, sat by the flesh pots, and when we did eat bread of the full. For you have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill us, to kill this whole assembly with hunger. See, they thought that Moses had brought them out into the wilderness to kill them. The facts are, Moses had killed for them. He had killed a man because he loved these people so much and wanted to help them. And he buried, you remember the story, buried the Egyptian and all like that. He had gone through all manner of trials and troubles and tribulations. He had done everything he knew to do. And they still said, ah, you know, he's out to kill us. You'll, by the way, you'll find that as you, you know, get along in your Christian life, and pretty soon you have a band of men and they're following you and you're trying to lead them somewhere and help them. You'll do everything right but one, and that'll be the one thing that they'll remember, you know. Ah, he's out to kill us. Well, you may have done 17 things, you know, stayed up late at night, worked, slaved, fingers to the bone, really tried, and then one little flaw and they'll all pounce on that. It's just something in human nature. Just that's the way it works. They thought that. See, if God had wanted to kill these people, he could have done it very nicely at the Red Sea. This giant mountain of water, and they're all, you know, kerslosh. That would have been the end of it. He wouldn't have had to go through this whole Mickey Mouse to bring them out of this wilderness. If he wanted to kill them, he'd have had the opportunity of that. But he went out to kill them. He was out to train them and to make something out of them. To really make something out of them. But, you know, they're all confused. They thought that he brought them out to kill them. Then said the Lord unto Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain rate every day, that I may prove them, whether they will walk in my law or no. And here is the first test, the first lesson he's going to teach them. It's going to be the lesson of faith. Interesting to me that I believe the first lesson that God put these people through when he brought them to the wilderness, or into this wilderness and through this training program, was a lesson in faith. Do they really trust him, and will they obey him? And you've heard it said many times, you know, that's the key to the whole business, trust and obey. For there's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey. And that's what God's out to find out now. He's out to test their faith, whether they will walk in his law or not. You see, when you're going through a test, and you will. If you've never really faced a big test in life to this point, cheer up, you will. Everybody goes through it. Nobody escapes it. Everybody goes through the tests of life. The vicissitudes of life face every person, every man, every woman. There's no way out of it. And when you're in the middle of one of these things, and some of them are mighty big and mighty agonizing, when you're in the middle of one of them, you will probably not doubt God. You will not doubt the existence of God. What you will doubt, you will doubt his goodness and his power. You will say to yourself, God has forgotten me. You will pray and it will be just like praying to that thing. Nothing. Or you'll, you know, cry out for relief from the thing and no relief will come. Or something will happen and pretty soon you'll figure it out, that God just does not have power to overcome this thing for you, to bring you through it. You'll doubt his power, and you'll doubt his goodness. Or you maybe say to yourself, well, he's forgotten about me. Every, you know, 8 billion people on the earth around here running around, and he's forgotten about me down here. I'm off of here, and he's, you know, he's lost sight of me. But that's what you'll doubt, his goodness. You'll never doubt God himself. You'll never say, there is no God. You'll always believe that. But you'll somehow figure it out that he's not really good to you at this point, or that he just doesn't have the power to bring you through it, or to do anything about it. That's what you'll doubt. You'll doubt his power. Now, when God set out to train these people and chose faith as the first lesson to teach them, and then his method of doing this, I was struck by the fact that at the same time I've been reading in the New Testament, in this little thing you have a New Testament reading and an Old Testament reading, you know, the same deal. I was reading in Luke, and I began to see that that's probably exactly what Jesus was doing with these men. The big thing that Jesus Christ did for his apostles, the men that followed him, was test their faith. He tried to make men of faith out of them. I've just been reading in Luke lately, in the reading here. If you'd like to turn to Luke for two or three little verses here, or passages, to kind of get a New Testament picture of this Old Testament truth. It's Luke 8, beginning reading in verse 22. It says, "Now it came to pass on a certain day that he went into a ship with his disciples, and he said unto them, Let us go over unto the other side of the lake. And they launched forth. And as they sailed, he fell asleep. And there came down a storm of wind on the lake, and they were filled with water and were in jeopardy." Now this test is not a fake test. The test that God puts you through will not be fakes. It'll not be some phony situation that he contrives, just, you know, and you can obviously see it's phony. It'll be a real thing, a real bona fide problem. Here they are in a violent storm on the lake. The boat is filled with water, and they are in jeopardy. "And they came to him and awoke him, saying, Master, Master, we perish." Now get the picture. The wind is blowing. The waves are, you know, mountainous. Because, you know, you've read the stories of the storms on these lakes over there. The boat is filled with water. They are in jeopardy. So they go to the Lord and they say, twice, you know, Master. Master. we perish, you know. We perish. But, you know, they try to figure out how to say this, you know, in a simple way, so that you know, apply it to action or something, you know. "Then he arose and rebuked the wind and the raging of the water, and they ceased, and there was a great calm." The first thing he rebukes is the wind and the water. Then he turns to them. "Where is your faith?" he asked them. And he gives them a little word on this business of no faith. The wind, the waves, the boat is filled with water, they are sinking, they are in jeopardy. "Where is your faith?" he asked them. I also jotted down Luke 22, 7 through 13, recently, another portion of the reading. And Luke 19, 29 through 35. I won't take time to read them. But the one is Luke 22, 7 through 13. The other one is Luke 19, 29 through 35. The one was where they going to get the upper room so they might have the Last Supper together. "Now go to the town. You'll find a man. He'll say this. You say that. Then he'll say this. And you say that. And then go." Is that it? That's it. So they went. They go to the town. He says this. They say that. You know, and sure enough, that's the way it works out. Or they're going to go find a donkey for him to ride in the town on, you know, this great procession that they're going to go in prior to Easter. So what do? Well, you find a man, he'll have a colt tied, you'll start, and the man will come up and say, "What are you doing with the colt?" "Well, I work," and then so, right? So they go, "What are you doing with the colt?" That, and exactly the way it worked out, you know, every time. What he's trying to do is get them so they have faith in his word. because he is not going to be with them all this time. So, if you'll just remember what I said and put your faith in that, then that's the way it will work out. Because had they remembered in Luke 8 that he said, "Let us go over unto the other side." That was his intent. Had they remembered that, they wouldn't have, you know, been so worried. They thought what he said was, "Let us go out into the middle and sink." But that wasn't what he said. He told them, "Let us go to the other side." Had they remembered that. So over and over and over again, he tries to get them to the point where they have faith in his word, because that is what they will have after he is gone. And it's, as you read the New Testament, just look for that. It's a fascinating thing how over and over and over and over he does it. But now come with me to Romans chapter 5, and you'll see how the test works in with faith. Because that's what he did in Exodus 16. He was going to test their faith. In Romans 5, beginning reading in verse, let's see, 3, I guess. Well, we might as well read the first two verses. Romans chapter 5. "Therefore, being justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ." Romans chapter 5, verse 1. "Therefore, being justified by faith." Now, by the way, the word justification here that he uses, the word justify, this is a legal term that the Apostle Paul pulls out of the hat. It's a legal term. It means the legal act of God by which he declares the sinner righteous on the basis of the perfect righteousness of Christ. That's justification. And it's a legal term that he uses. And by the way, a man's legal standing can be changed, you know, that quick. Legally, you're, you know, like that, and you're different. That's why he uses this word, this legal term, I think. See, and I recall when I was married, I'm standing here, you know, and my wife is coming down the aisle, and so I'm waiting, and, you know, and some guy says, "What are you, single or married?" "I'm single." You know, and so she gets halfway down the aisle. "What are you, single?" I'm single. She gets down here to me, you know, and we link up, you know, and, "What are you?" "No, I'm still single." And then he says, "I now pronounce you man and wife." "What are you?" "I'm married." Legally, my status has been changed that quick. God declares a person righteous. Legally, he is declared righteous. Justification is objective. There's nothing subjective about justification. That is an objective thing. See, whether you feel like it or not, you are righteous. God declares it so. It's interesting that he's not used the word pardon here, because pardon assumes guilt. But to justify a person, see, the law either declares you totally righteous or totally guilty, and there's no in-between. The judge does not say, "Well, he's more or less guilty." Or, "Well, he's more or less righteous." No, you either totally one or totally other. And when a person comes to Christ, he is totally righteous. And it's a greater thing than a pardon, because this pardons, he assumes guilt. And isn't it interesting, in the Old Testament, even when this pardon business, you know, "Let him return unto the Lord, and he will abundantly pardon." More than just pardon, but abundantly pardon. But this is even greater than that. This is a declaration of righteousness. Legally, our standing is righteous before God. "By whom we have access," and by the way, the word "access" assumes that you didn't always have it. "By whom we have access by faith unto the state of grace wherein we stand, and rejoice in the hope of the glory of God." This hope, this joyful, confident expectation, this hope of God, the glory of God. Then he says, "And not only so, but we glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation worketh patience." Now, the word tribulation, means going through the threshing machine. It's an old, old word. That's what it means, going through the threshing machine. It means staying power. It's trouble. It's test. It's pressure. I guess the basic word is pressure, if you want the basic word for that. Then. Pressure. Affliction. Probably pressure is as good as any. And the word patience, this is the word for endurance. That's what patience is. It's an unfortunate translation, I think, here, although I guess you can come back by that. But anyhow, it means endurance. Staying power, this endurance, you know. Well, the only way that God can build endurance in a person's life is through testings, the pressure. That is the only way that God has to do that. You can search the scriptures from one end to the other and you'll find this is God's way. Therefore, when the tests of faith come, we must not forget or lose sight of God's way of doing things. See, the sky is not always blue. Today the sky will be blue, I guess. Well, the sky is not always blue. Sometimes there are dark clouds around. There are two reasons, I guess, why God allows tests to come our way. One is the simple, obvious reason that we're living in enemy territory. We are behind the enemy lines. The prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now worketh in the children of disobedience, the God of this world, and so on. We are living in enemy territory. And secondly, it's good for us because it produces Christian character. And it's the only thing that does. See, a tree in a hothouse is a perfect tree, but it's spindly. But it's perfect, but it's kind of thin and spindly, and the root system is not really good. But a tree out where the winds are, and out where the real tests of life come, it's no more healthy than the tree in the hothouse. It's just different. It's rugged. It's got a root system. It's strong. I watched the wind come at Glen Eyrie. And I imagine all of you have been at Glen Eyrie. You've seen those huge, huge trees, those beautiful things standing there. Well, in Colorado, the wind can really whip up. We lost two gates last year. You know, off they go. Well, the wind really comes. And I watched those trees, even those big ones, and they bend. And I've watched men, Christians, who have a good root system, strong men, but they bend. The key to it, of course, is God allows, you know, the light winds to come first and a little stronger and a little stronger. But he's always testing that faith. He is testing that faith. And then these things produce a confidence in God. See, what we must face the fact that God is not so much interested in our comfort as he is in our character. God is not particularly interested in your comfort. What he is out to do is produce character, Christian character. Our completeness as men and women. You know the lady that wrote, "Day by day and with each passing moment, strength I find to meet my trials here." She was out in boating with her father. And the boat overturned and her father was drowned. So she came to shore and went in and she wrote another song. It's a song we don't sing very much except in the Swedes sing, and I heard it in the Swedish church. "Children of the Heavenly Father, safely in his bosom gathered, nestling bird or star of heaven, such a refuge e'er was given. Though he giveth or he taketh, your protector ne'er forsaketh. His the loving purpose solely to preserve us, pure and holy." Now that's it. See, that is the reason for this whole business. Anyone know that song? Any of you people ever sing that hymn? You've sung it. Is it a Lutheran hymn? Such a rippy hymnal. I wish we had a Nav hymnal. In fact, I tried to get it. Have you ever, by the way, have you seen the new Navigator hymnal? Good. Nice. Good deal, you know. And I tried to get them to put that song in. They couldn't find it. I couldn't get a copyright or something. I forget what it was. But it's a fantastic song. Good little tune, you know. When you sing it, you really feel the thing. But God is not interested so much in our comfort as he is in our character, our completeness as men. Now, here's how this works. You take a piece of pottery, and it's all there. It's all there. You know, it's there. Then you put it in the furnace, and you heat that baby up 7 times hotter than it ought to be. Then you take it out of the kiln, and what's happened to it? Now there's a glow, there's a shine, there's colors in that thing that you never saw before when you put it through the heat. Now you watch people who have really gone through the heat, gone through the tests, gone through the fire, and you'll notice something about them. The attributes and character and personality and beauty of Jesus Christ begins to show through them a little more than people that have not gone through this. Lila Trotman, I guess, is probably the chief one that I think of when I think of this. You know, you look at Lila, and of course she's beautiful and she's radiant, but there's something else there. There's the character of Christ, there's the beauty of Christ, there's something that's showing through that woman that's just not an, you know, average woman on the street. What is that? Well, she's gone through the test. She's gone through the fire. She's gone through the trial. And Lila displays this thing that the pottery has. You see, you put the pottery in the furnace, and it's all the same as when you take it out, except that now there's a color and a glow and a brilliance and something there that wasn't there before. That's what heat does. Well, 1 Peter 4:12. My brethren, count it all joy. Oh, I'm sorry, that's James 1, but you know the story. Count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations. By the way, I count it joy when I climb out of various kinds of tests. He says, count it all joy when you fall into. Why? Knowing this, that the trial of your faith worketh patience, worketh endurance, see? The only way you get that endurance is that trial. Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you, though some strange thing happened to you, but rejoice. And by the way, here's another interesting thing. Whenever you find this word patience or this word endurance, the trial mentioned, you'll always find the idea of rejoicing attached to it. But rejoice. Notice in this passage in Romans 5, we glory, we exult in testings and trials and trouble and tribulations. We glory in them. Count it all joy when you fall into diverse testings. But rejoice, and so on. Acts 14:19. We must, through much tribulation, enter the kingdom of God. If you want an interesting little study, study the Battle of Gideon sometime. Judges 6 and 7. I've heard all kinds of sermons on this, and I've read books on it. But I think everybody's missed the point. The point of that battle of Gideon, what God was not trying to give them their farms back. He was trying to get them back. The people of God had strayed away and sinned against God. And every time I hear a sermon on that, it's always on the marvelous military tactics that God used to get them. And they got all this interesting stuff, all this intricate stuff worked out. See, all the tactics, all this military strategy and tactics. Nuts! That's not what God was trying to do. He wasn't trying to give these people their farms back so they go back and tread grapes. He was trying to get them back. And he had to do it in a certain way to make sure that they know God did it. Look at Colossians 1. I have to skip that. I was going to go take you through that, by the way, Judges 6 and 7. Do I have 5 minutes left? How much time do we have? Do I have 2 minutes left? Are we supposed to quit at 8:15? Are we supposed to quit now?
25 minutes. 25 up or 20.
Ah, okay. Well, we'll... Oh, terrific. Okay, come on, let's go. Let's go to Colossians. Oh, I see, all right. Let's go to Colossians 1 just for a second. See, this is such an interesting point and such a crucial point that I don't want us to miss this thing. But it's all through the Scriptures. Colossians 1, we'll begin reading in verse 9. For this cause we also, since the day we heard it, do not cease to pray for you, and desire that you might be filled with the knowledge of His will and all wisdom and spiritual understanding, that you might walk worthy of the Lord and do all pleasing, being fruitful in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God, strengthened with all might, according to His glorious power. By the way, now here it is. We're going to be strengthened with all might according to His glorious power. Unto what? Yes. Unto all patience. There's that word patience again. That's the idea of endurance. And long-suffering. Now, long-suffering is very simple. Long-suffering is long-suffering. See, that's what that is. Nothing doubtful about that thing. Long-suffering with what? Joyfulness. I understand that. See, every time you come across this idea of endurance, patience, long-suffering, you find the idea of joyfulness attached to it. Why? Because God is building things into our lives. And if we're in the midst of trials, in the midst of trouble, when they're real. See, they're not something fake that He makes up, but they're real. Hard, mean, ugly things. I mean, tough. If we can remember while we're in them that God is doing something in us and will produce something in us that's really good, then we can rejoice. We can say, Lord, I understand this, but praise God. Some of you know Ken Smith. I heard that Floyd, his wife, she worked in the Pink House at Glen Eyrie for a while and was with Dawson, Lila, and then she fell in love with this young Presbyterian minister back in Pittsburgh and married him. And the guy that I had known for a couple of years back there when we were in Pittsburgh. And I guess a couple of years ago, we got word at the Glen that Floyd had cancer. So immediately I got on the phone and called Ken. Oh, praise God, Lee. Oh, God is, we're rejoicing. God is good. You know. He said, Lee, the promises of God are true. They're really true. In the midst of this trial, God was proving Himself faithful. Some of you know Ron Rohrbaugh, Ron and Selva. Selva used to write the scripts for the Hayloft Opera at Glen Eyrie. This was back in the old ancient days. And she was quite a performer. She's a terrific gal. And Ron lived in our home in Omaha. I learned to love this guy. He was an engineer for Pratt & Whitney. Had a little baby. And the boy died. So they had another boy, and he died of the same thing. And they wrote us a letter. And they're rejoicing, happy. You know, God was proving Himself faithful and all. God was giving them comfort of heart and comfort of spirit. And they were finding joy in the midst of all this. And they had a chance to witness everybody around them and so on and on. Some of you know Jolie and Pam and their little boy, you know, the little situation they had with their baby. And they wrote a letter, and I got to read it that morning at Glen Eyrie to the rest of the gang, and how they were rejoicing in the goodness of God through all this, as the boy was taken, just practically in birth. Well, look what it says. That you might walk worthy of the Lord into all pleasing, being fruitful in every good work, and increasing in the knowledge, strengthened with all might according to His glorious power, unto... Not unto some great service for God. Did you notice that? Not unto... By the way, now this is the power of God. See? This is the power of God. This is His glorious power. Not unto some ecstatic experience or something that's good for you. See? Something that you can have. But it's unto all patience and long-suffering with joyfulness. When you see a person going through that kind of thing and see the love of Christ and the joy of Christ on their face, that is the power of God right there. If you're looking for the power of God somewhere, that's it. You've just found it. Now turn with me to Acts chapter 13. And then we're going to go back to Exodus 16. I'm going to try to get through that chapter. Acts chapter 13. You recall here how the Apostle Paul is out preaching He's preaching in Antioch. This is not Antioch that they had back in Acts 11. This is Antioch of Pisidia, this little out-of-the-way town. And as they're preaching along, Acts 13, verse 50, it says, "But the Jews stirred up the devout and honorable women and the chief men of the city and raised persecution against Paul and Barnabas and expelled them out of their coasts." Now, they raised persecution and threw them out of town, but nothing really happened to them. So it says they were aware of it and they fled down to Iconium. Acts 14, verse 5. "And when there was an assault made, both of the Gentiles and also the Jews with their rulers, to use them despitefully and to stone them, they were aware of it and fled to Lystra and Derbe." That happened at Iconium. Lystra and Derbe. Now look at verse 19. "And there came thither certain Jews from Antioch and Iconium, who persuaded the people, and having stoned Paul, drew him out of the city, supposing he had been dead." Now come with me to Timothy. I think it's 2 Timothy 3. Yeah, beginning with verse 10. Now if you can catch this one. This is really interesting. "But thou hast fully known my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, charity, patience." And by the way, when I read this over in Acts, I thought, well, that's not bad. Let's see. First place, they tried to persecute him and stone him, but he got out of it. That's not bad. The deliverance of God. Then the second one, you know, they chased him, but he got out of town, you know, didn't do anything right, but they didn't stone him, deliverance of God. But the third one, they got him. "And they stoned Paul and dragged him out of town, supposing he had been dead." They stoned him to death. And then picked him up, dragged him out of town, and left him outside the gate. I thought, well, now, Lee, that's not bad. If you can just make it 2 out of 3, that's a pretty good average. You know? The 2 out of 3 things you face, if God brings you out of it, why the third one you could probably take? That's okay. 2 out of 3. Pretty good average. Back to 2 Timothy. Verse 10. "Thou hast fully known my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, charity, patience." There's that endurance again. "Persecutions, afflictions, which came to me at Antioch, Iconium, at Lystra." Remember the little situation we just read? "What persecutions I endured, but out of them all the Lord delivered me." All your foot, 2 out of 3, but not all. He was stoned to death at that last one. So then I had to meditate on that a little bit. He was delivered from the stones twice and through the stones once. But still, God delivered him. And that's what's going to happen to you. God will deliver you from lots of things. And then once in a while, to test your faith, he will deliver you through something. And that's what you'll remember when God brings you through these things. When he takes you around the thing, you look back and it won't even register on the seismograph, the soul seismograph that you have. It won't even flicker, you know. But boy, when he brings you through the thing, that one will jiggle. But you'll look back and remember that one. That is when God really builds faith in a man or a woman's life. Now back to Exodus chapter 16. Oh man, I can't go into all that. Well, but it's no point. I mean, you know. Well, anyhow, you get the idea in Exodus 16. He starts out to test their faith, and he does so. And then Moses takes his stand. The murmurings are not against God, against us. And verse 6, he says, you know, "You shall know that the Lord brought you out of the land of Egypt." See, one of the reasons why Moses was such a great leader, he didn't say, well, now, here's the situation, gang. God told me that tonight, now, there's going to be bread fall out of the sky. Now, that's what God, don't blame me if it doesn't happen. I'm not the one that said it, but I'll just tell you what God said. He said there's going to be some bread fall down here. Now, you can take that for what it's worth, but... See, Moses staked his character on the character of God. He said, there will be bread fall down. God will do this. And he aligned himself. Oh, man. Look at Daniel chapter 2. See, it's very easy to do the other. It is very easy. But to align yourself with God and stake your character on the character of God, that's something else entirely. You recall the situation, you know. Daniel is... They face a problem here. They can't show the king the dream. And in 2:16 it says, then Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time and that he would show the king the interpretation. Not might, but would. If you give me time, I will show you the meaning of that dream. It was a step of faith. See, back to faith again. That was a step of faith for Moses to do that. Tonight, God will rain bread down, or tomorrow morning, or whatever it was. There will be bread fall out of those clouds up there. That's a step of faith on his part. And it's very easy to do the other, by the way. It's awfully easy. Well, then you come over to Acts. By the way, I'm going to give you a verse in Acts 16 before we get to Acts 17. Just for you to think about it. Look at Acts 17:28. Well, I'll go back to 27. And it came to pass that there went out some of the people on the seventh day for together, and they found none. You remember they weren't supposed to go out on the seventh day. And the Lord said unto Moses, this is Acts 16. I'm sorry, Exodus. Oh, I said Exodus. I'm back to Moses again. Exodus, yeah, 16:27. It came to pass that there went out some of the people on the seventh day to gather, and they found none. And the Lord said unto Moses, how long refuse ye to keep my commandments and my laws? Now, Moses hadn't gone out, but the people had. But he held Moses responsible for what they had done. How long refuse ye to keep my commandments and my laws? He asked Moses. Well, I cross-reference that with James 3:1. My brethren, be not many teachers, knowing that we should receive the greater condemnation. Exodus 16:27-28, cross-reference with James 3:1. Now you come to Exodus 17. And all the congregation of the children of Israel journeyed from the wilderness of Sin after their journeyings according to the commandment of the Lord and pitched in Rephidim. And there was no water for the people to drink. Ah. First we have no food. Now no water. Wherefore the people did chide with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. Now here they are. They're all standing in the same boat, you know. It's as dusty around Moses as it is around them. And they all look at Moses, give us water. Water, you know. And Moses said to them, why chide ye with me? Wherefore do you tempt the Lord? And the people thirsted there for water. And the people murmured against Moses and said, wherefore is this that thou hast brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our cattle with thirst? And Moses cried unto the Lord, saying, what shall I do unto this people? They be almost ready to stone me. And the Lord said unto Moses, go on before the people, and take with thee the elders of Israel and thy rod where thou smotest the river, and take in thine hand, and go, and behold, I will stand before thee there upon the rock of Horeb, and thou shalt smite the rock, and there shall come water out of it. And by the way, I'll give you some cross-references here. But that water that came out of that rock, that was not just a trickle. That apparently became a rushing, mighty river that followed them all over the wilderness. Psalm 78:15-16. I didn't know this before, but I began to cross-reference this. And I'm still not really sure, but I wouldn't, you know, stake my life on it. But I think that's the way I read this. Psalm 78:15-16. Psalm 114:8. Numbers 21:16-18. Isaiah 43:20. And then if you want to read something that just knocks you off your seat, 1 Corinthians 10:4. The rock was Christ. Out of his innermost being shall flow rivers of living water. Not just a trickle, not just an eyedropper, not just a dab enough to, you know, do some little good here. But to the man who really has the fullness of Christ in his life, out of his innermost being shall flow rivers that will satisfy for days and days and days and days and days. Now, verse 8. Then came Amalek and fought with Israel in Rephidim. By the way, she's still testing their faith. In first part there, Acts 17:1-7. Still a test of faith. Now, that was in provision. Now he's going to test their faith in protection. The provision of God, they've got pretty well established now. They can provide, you know, they can provide bread out of the clouds, and they can provide water out of the rocks. So now they got that established. Now we're going to have one more test here. Then came Amalek and fought with Israel at Rephidim, and Moses said unto Joshua, choose us out men, and go and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. So Joshua did as Moses had said unto him, and fought with Amalek. And Moses and Aaron and Hur went up the top of the hill. And it came to pass, when Moses held up his hand, that Israel prevailed. When he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. Now, by the way, Joshua, you know, a type of Christ, Joshua meaning Savior, God our Savior. See, Jesus Christ is both our Joshua and our Moses. Christ is also fighting the battle. He is our victory. But he's also our intercessor. So Christ is both of these to us. And I imagine it was a great comfort for the people to see Joshua down there fighting it out, and then look up and hear Moses praying. But the battle did not depend, in this case, primarily upon Joshua, but upon Moses. Because when he was lifting up his hands and praying to God, the battle went, you know, Israel prevailed. When he let down his hands, Amalek prevailed. And, of course, you know what they did. Bring some props. You know, they prop his arms up so he could stand there and pray. Their first battle, and they're going to face many of them now as they go along, their first battle is won by prayer. Not by power. Not by might. But by prayer. The first battle they fight, it's won by prayer. And so, verse 15, Moses built an altar, and call the name of it Jehovah Nissi, which means Jehovah our banner, Jehovah our victory. 1 Corinthians 15:57. Christ is our victory. By the way, if you know, one other interesting study sometime, take all the names of God in the Old Testament, Jehovah Jireh, Jehovah Nissi, Jehovah this and that and the other thing, Jehovah our provider, Jehovah our victory, Jehovah our the Lord our shepherd, and so on. All the names of God, and then see how it was that Christ fulfilled each of these in his own life. You know, I have manifested thy name unto the man whom thou hast given me. Well, he did. By his life, he manifested every name of God in the Old Testament He manifested that name by an act in the New Testament. I have manifested thy name. Well, Acts 18, he finally gets them organized. Jethro, I believe God sent this man Jethro. And here we're going to quit. Moses was a man who spoke to God. God came and spoke to Moses face to face. So then this Jethro, the priest of Midian, shows up and sits down and gives Moses a little instruction, a little counsel. Man, thou wilt surely wear away, both thou and this people that is with thee. Thou art not able to bear it thyself alone. You remember the situation. That Moses would sit and the people would come and they would explain to him and say, I'll do this, I'll do that, you know. And he would lay it on them. Whatever their problem was, he would give them the simple, obvious answer, the way to handle the thing. And it happened all day. Jethro came and said, look, you be to the people for Godward, and then let's get some other people involved here. Which, by the way, is a terrific principle of leadership. Get everybody involved that you can, so they can develop and learn, and they can grow and become strong in their own right, making big ones out of little ones. But Moses did not say to Jethro, who are you to tell me what to do? I have been spoken to by God himself, but now some Midian comes along going to give me some counsel. Now, Moses was not above counsel. You know, he was... See, a wise man will hear and will increase in learning. Moses was wise, but he was wise enough to hear what the old guy had to say and increase in learning and learn something else, something new, something more. We should then strive to involve others. And then he said this, verse 21, moreover, thou shalt provide out of the people able men. And by the way, if you want an interesting study sometime, study what we're supposed to be able to do. Take your concordance, get the word able. Able to know the love of Christ. Able to teach others also. Able. What we're supposed to be able to do as Christians. Able men, such as fear God. This is your spiritual life, see, that you're... Men of truth, honesty, truth, hating covetousness. This contempt for wealth. No, I won't do it. I'm going to quit. Maybe we can pick up there. I have an interesting cross-reference on that, but we've got to quit. You're here for the summer. I don't know how long for the summers. I don't know how long your training program is. Probably not 40 years. You might thank God for that. But, you know, your morale is still pretty good, I imagine. You know, things are still going good. But one of these days, you're going to be tempted by, you know, tested by something or other. Lousy birds in the morning out there chirping. Lousy airplanes going over, you know, thundering. Lousy food, I don't know, whatever it is, you know. Lousy heat. Miserable people on Earth, hemisphere, tromping around, you know. Well, I don't know what it's going to be, but God will test you. You will go through some kind of a test. But when you do, remember this. He is testing your faith.